welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 251 of the podcast. And it is the 9th of January, 2016, as I record this. So this week, I have an interview with Ankur Nagpal from Teachable.com, which is a great platform for hosting online courses and the service I'm now using for my own successful self-publishing course and creative freedom course. And as you'll hear in the interview, I'm so pleased to have a platform that deals with all the technical side as well as the money side. I have run a direct sales solution before, and it was a pain in the neck. And I gave up my own self-hosted courses at the end of 2014, mainly, well, one, I needed to update the material, but two, the EU VAT laws came in. And of course, now they're much more widespread than just the EU. So, and I'm pretty sure they're going to be across the whole world within the next year because they make so much money for governments. But essentially, Teachable was really super useful, and I'm really pleased to bring you Ankur's interesting stuff today. And you can find out more at thecreativepen.com/teachable. And also you can find more about my courses at thecreativepen.com/courses. So in personal news, I have had an awesome first week of dictation, and I'm really excited about it, actually. If you listen to the interview with Monica Lionel last year, I can't remember, it was October or something like that, you'll probably hear in my voice the resistance to doing dictation. But I'm really surprised at how well it's gone this week. I've got 10,000 words done on Destroyer of Worlds, the next Arcane book, and some of that was walking in the park pretending I was on the phone. So I'm really pleased that I have started the walking and talking as well as doing it at my desk. And Dragon plus the various mic setup I'm using has worked out sort of 95% accurate. I've had to I have chosen character names that are easy to say, but given that this book, Destroyer of Worlds, is set in India and is about a statue of Shiva Nataraja, that's quite difficult. So, you know, sometimes it's quite hard, but I found that it's getting better and better. And I also dictated the first draft of a blog post, and nonfiction is actually much easier because there's fewer open quote, comma, close quote, said Morgan, full stop. But dialogue is also better in dictation in some ways because you have the sort of more natural speaking style. So I will be sharing a lot more tips once I am sure of what I'm doing and my process has bedded down a bit, and I'll let you know about all the tech and that stuff later on. I've also got an interview coming with Elle Casey in a couple of weeks, who's a romance writer who's also shifted to dictation, and we both kind of wax lyrical about it. So that's exciting. So this week, I've also booked my flight for Austin, Texas for the Smarter Artists Summit, where I will be speaking on the future of publishing, which is very exciting. That is March 30th, 31st in Austin, Texas, and you can get tickets at smarterartistsummit.com. And there will be lots of people there from all over the self-publishing world. It's going to be really cool. I'm looking forward to that. So big publishing news this week is Penguin Random House selling Author Solutions to an investment company. So it's really good in mainly in the way that a traditional publishing company has decided they don't want to be associated with Author Solutions. It doesn't mean the imprints are going away, but they're no longer under Penguin Random House, which means authors won't think that they're being published by this very well-known brand. So I'll link to David Goffran's post about this, but essentially these imprints are still around, but it's good news, I think, that they've done that, because there was a lot of pressure from the author world on that side of things. Also wanted to correct last week's show, Amar Vyas emailed to say that Flipkart in India closed their ebook store only, but is still a massive e-commerce site. And Daily Hunt is the biggest competitor to Amazon for ebooks in India. I also listened to a brilliant podcast from BBC World on e-commerce in India this week, and I'll link to that in the show notes, where the head of Amazon India said it was minute one, day one in terms of e-commerce in India. So things are just getting started. And as you all know, I'm very sort of bullish on international growth. And so I'm going to be lowering the price of my Indian ebooks to probably 60 rupees to up to 100 rupees in the hope of building up readership in India for the long term. And that converts to a tiny, tiny amount of money in Western currencies, but it's more about a long-term goal and being there right at the beginning. And I'm currently, talking about India, I'm currently researching cool things about Mumbai for Destroyer of Worlds, which is, as I mentioned, a lot of Indian stuff in there, and really doing some fascinating research. So anyway, if you know cool things about Mumbai, please do tweet me at The Creative Pen. Oh, and also from last week's show, SJ Pajonas wanted to mention that if you are purchasing on an iPhone, she has a bookmark straight to the Kindle store on Safari. And if she hears something, we'll switch over, purchase it and switch back. So I talked very much about, the in-app problem with in-app purchases on the iPhone. And will that mean iBooks will take more people given their dominance with iPhones, and the fact that Amazon doesn't have a phone anymore, I don't think. Really interesting. I always like to hear about how people do purchase ebooks. Really interesting to see you do that, SJ, because I don't do that. I just write down titles and then buy them on my laptop, I should say. So something cool coming up on 11th of January. You might remember I had the lovely Chandler Bolt on the podcast last year. One of the young entrepreneurs I respect very much, wrote his own self-published book and has built a seven-figure business based on his non-fiction book, and featured in Business Insider. You know, super, super young entrepreneur. If you are writing non-fiction, then I definitely think you should check out what Chandler's doing. You can get his free video series at thecreativepen.com/SPS. That stands for Self-Publishing School. And that will include his blueprint to go from blank page to best-selling author in 90 days. Now, I, of course, have stuff for self-publishing, but I think if you want to write a non-fiction book that specifically is about driving a business, and that is a small segment of my audience, then I really think Chandler's stuff is fantastic. So definitely, I mean, he does have fiction authors on his list, but from what I've seen of it and talked to him about and his own experience, pretty much non-fiction focused on writing your book in 90 days, getting it to the bestseller list and building a business behind it. So check that video out at thecreativepen.com/SPS. And that is time critical, but I'm pretty sure I will make sure that link goes to whatever the latest homepage is. So here's what you've sent me in the last few weeks. Matthew Broff says, the podcast this week on your creative process was awesome. Thank you for sharing. Glad you enjoyed, Matthew. Marcus Aman says, oh, this was great. Marcus picked up Risen Gods, my dark fantasy thriller written with Jay Thorne, picked that up on the way to New Zealand. And he tweeted saying, just finished Risen Gods. I loved Rangi. I visited many of the places mentioned during my whirlwind New Zealand holiday and enjoyed the adventure on both counts. So that's fantastic. Thank you, Marcus. Tyler Underwood says, listening to your podcast while working my day job in construction, feeling mighty good with these creative mornings. Martin Granger. Oh, replied about dictation, said, have been using Dragon for 18 years, first for film scripts, now for books, makes dialogue much easier, enjoy. That is what I see for my future. I pretty much fast forward 18 years, I figure I will be the one saying that on whatever social network we have by then. Thanks, Martin. Kitty Murray says, listening to the last podcast. Wow, so much great information. We'll have to re-listen a couple of times. There's always the show notes, although I don't really do detailed show notes on the introduction. Just I do have links, and you can always find those at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. T.S. Hottle says, here's the view from work as I listen to the Creative Pen podcast. One of the better mornings in this El Nino winter. A nice blue sky in the early morning there. Meg Cowley says, another illustration completed for my next colouring book, a productive hour listening to the podcast. Now, Meg is doing incredibly well with the adult colouring book craze. She very sensibly jumped into it early on and is doing very, very well. So good on you, Meg, and I hope you've done another illustration while listening to this show. Billy Grogan enjoyed listening to the latest and longest but great episode while driving from Columbus to Atlanta. Nice suit, Billy, looking good in that picture. Edwin Downwood listened to your year in review episode while driving home from having a root canal. Sorry about that, Edwin. Hope you're not in too much pain. Amy Draper listened on the way to the day job and intends to reinvigorate her goal to publish her first book in 2016. Well, Amy, if you're listening to this show, we're going to hold you to that. So I'll remind you this time next year. Christine Niles, taking the Creative Pen podcast on a 15-hour road trip, feeling smarter and ready to take on 2016. And Honoré says, we're keeping her in the gym an extra long time this morning. Loved this meaty episode. Thanks, Honoré, and see you in Austin. I'm excited about that. Honoré will be there, so that's cool. So today's episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and today I'm going to do the ad read because I wanted to talk a bit more about box sets and what you can do outside Amazon that might surprise you. So at Kobo, and indeed Affle, although they're not sponsoring the show, you don't get penalised for pricing above $9.99, and you can put your book, any book, in fact, perma-free, or change the price to free and back up again. You can also schedule price promotions and set and forget anytime, more than once every 90 days if you like, rather than having to go back into the platform and remembering to change your price back. So essentially, you get much more freedom over pricing, and that means you can do mega box sets, and I'm talking single author box sets here. So I've just looked at my 2015 sales and income reports from Kobo, and my top two best-selling titles, as in the two titles that made me the most money, they actually made nearly half of my income from Kobo in 2015, were the Arcane Thriller box sets 1 and 2. And just to put that in context, Kobo was in total around 25% of my book sales in 2015. So it's not an insignificant amount from those two box sets. So why is that interesting? Well, first of all, if I hadn't have put those books into box sets, and each one has three books, I wouldn't have made that money. Now, some people worry that doing a single author box set cannibalizes sales on the individual books. I don't think it does. I think it's actually a different audience who buy box sets, and they're often people who are looking for a good deal on multiple books and who want a chunkier sort of experience. It's the binge reading approach. It's like, if I get all these books together, I can spend like the whole weekend reading and I don't even have to leave one file. And it's so interesting because just having a look at one of the latest sales that Kobo have done promotions on box sets, I saw Bella Andre has a 5-book box set and Tina Folsom has a 9-book box set. Now, these are romance, of course, but the same deal applies to whichever genre you're in. Those are single author box sets, as in a box set created from your own books, not multi-author box sets, which are usually used for marketing purposes. These box sets are for income purposes. And I'm just super excited about this. And the great thing is, of course, you can price above $9.99. So if you put 9 books together in a box set, you can potentially sell that for $20 or whatever you want to sell it for. Or you could put it for $30 and then reduce the price by $10 and still get a $20 sale, because Kobo doesn't penalize you and you'll still get 70% royalty. Whereas Amazon, you can't price over $9.99. without going back to the 35% royalty. So that's pretty amazing. And I have a nonfiction writer's toolbox, which is on Kobo at US £12.99 or £9.99. And although my Arcane box sets are also on Amazon, I'm now planning on doing a mega Arcane box set. I'm wondering whether to do the existing 7 books or whether to wait and do a 10 book box set when I get to 10. Still thinking about that. But you know, the thing is, if you consider the possibilities, I think if you have more than 3 books, it would be great to do a box set. Higher priced books mean that you can do more promotional sales, and Kobo customers aren't trained to get free books, or you know, really trained so much as Amazons are with KDP Select. So I think it's such a fascinating thing that we haven't even really seen what these can do yet. And I've certainly seen other, you know, George R. R. Martin box sets full priced at sort of £25. There are so many things we can do. Now, to get a box set, all you need to do is compile your multiple books together in Scrivener or whichever package you're using to compile your own books, or pay somebody to put them all in one file and get a cover designed. I mean, the amount of work involved is very, very small. And Kobo has a preference for flat covers. And in fact, I'm based on Kobo's recommendation over using flat covers, I'm changing all my covers to flat instead of 3D, and seeing if that makes a difference at the other stores. Apple also has a preference for flat covers. But have a look at somebody like Bella Andre as to how she does them, or have a look at mine. So yeah, there you go. If you are wanting to expand your book sales and your market in 2016, go to kobo.com/writinglife to check out Publishing Direct on Kobo, and have a look at on the Kobo books.com and have a look at the box sets. Super interesting. Okay, so this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but the time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. I should, and thanks especially to new patron Christine Niles. Thanks, Christine, and to everyone supporting on Patreon. And just a reminder that I sent out an email for your Q&A questions. I will be recording the Patreon supporters only Q&A this coming week, and you all have the link if you support me on Patreon. So if you would like to get that extra Q&A, or you would like to support the show with even just a dollar twice a month, go to patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, let's get on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Ankur Nagpal. Hi Ankur.
Hi, Joanna. It's great to be here.
Yes, great to have you on the show. A very brief introduction. Ankur is the founder and CEO of Teachable.com, a site for creating and selling online courses, which is super exciting. And I want to start by sort of just give us a little bit more background about you, Ankur, and what's your kind of entrepreneurial background?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in the very fortunate position to have never held a real job in my life. I started out building Facebook applications my freshman summer of 2007. Kind of did that through most of my college years till the year after. And you know, built a pretty successful business just building and selling Facebook applications that were very successful but added negligibly little value in the world. Like things like personality quizzes, friend quizzes, send your friends a gift. Did that for, you know, a few years. It was good because it exposed me to the world of entrepreneurship. And after that, I was like, you know, I can't get a job now. I can't have a boss. Can't deal with that stuff. And then, you know, I reached a point where right after that, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. Moved to New York, and I started doing a little bit of online teaching. You know, on Udemy, I was doing a bit of teaching in person at General Assembly. And I started to believe in the world of online courses. But the solutions out there at the time just didn't really resonate with me. You know, as a teacher, I wanted something better. And that's how we built Teachable. It started out as a side project, just like something I built for my own courses, for my buddy Conrad's courses. And, you know, before we knew it, we started, you know, working with other people, and this became kind of what it is today.
But I wanted to ask you, I mean, many of us, you know, including myself, we've been doing courses, online courses for years. Like, online courses is not new. So what has happened in the last probably year, 18 months, that have made it seem as if online education has just gone nuts? Like, what is the shift that's happening in the world?
I think it's one of those things where I hate like bringing up Malcolm Gladwell and all that stuff, but you know, the tipping point, right? It generally takes several years of something happening before it kind of reaches escape velocity and becomes more significant. I think that's all that it is. Like, I compare it to even the world of mobile games. Mobile games have existed for, you know, 15 years, but they truly hit velocity about an acceleration about 5 to 6 years ago. I think the same thing is happening with online education. Things happen slower than you think it does. Like 5, 10 years ago, that was early, and it's just now hit kind of critical mass and things are accelerating. Of course, it's compounded by the fact that, you know, traditional education may or may not be that useful. But what I see a lot of people kind of comparing the kinds of online courses we sell, the kinds of online courses you sell, as an alternative to education. What's interesting is most people taking these courses have also gone through formal education. It's not even an alternative, it's more additive. It's more lifelong learning that you do after traditional education. But I think it's just, you know, critical mass that has been hit, along with the fact that right now we're producing a lot more video and photos of like any generation, right? Like, recording video has become so easy now. And recording high quality video, like sound that sounds good, is becoming more and more commoditized. And that's only going to happen further. So I think those factors have contributed to the growth of online education.
Yeah, I agree with you. And also, like you said, it's more just-in-time education. And like I don't want to spend 4 years doing a marketing course, yep, but I'm happy to pay for a small course on something specific, like, say, Facebook ads. You know, so is that it as well, that the courses that are coming out are more granular and more specific than like just a degree size thing?
Yep. And I think the other big difference is they're all, at least the successful courses we've seen, are outcome-oriented. There is a clear transformation, a clear outcome you achieve out of the course. It's not a credential. You're not doing it because you have to. There's one specific outcome you want to get. And the flip side of that is, I think as a course creator, you should always think about my course, what is the one outcome for a student, right? What is the one transformation? Because that's what the successful courses are right now. Like, you know, you mentioned Facebook Ads for Authors has a very clear outcome of what happens for you. Who is this for? And what is the outcome for completing the course? Which is different from traditional education, where very often, you know, philosophy 101 does not have a specific outcome for that course. And what's succeeding now is courses with an outcome.
Mm. And do you think also that people are more happy to pay for things online? Like, is that the other tipping point?
Yeah, I think we talked about that before. But yeah, people are much more comfortable spending money online, right? Like, that's right from my mom, who is a non-believer in e-commerce. Like, it just seemed like this bizarre concept. I have these like long lists of things I'm supposed to order from, because she doesn't live in America, but she sends me specific lists of, you know, hey, go to Sephora, order this, go here, order that. Like, you know, like, that's just one anecdotal example. But yeah, I mean, we spend more money online all the time. And, you know, this has kind of jumped on that bandwagon.
Mm. So the listeners are authors and they, yep, have books. So some are fiction, some are nonfiction. So what are the kinds of courses, if they, because of course, the great thing is that people pay more for a course, yep, than they do for a book. What are the types of courses that nonfiction and fiction authors can be thinking of creating?
So for nonfiction authors, it's obviously a lot easier, right? Because a lot of times a course is, you know, almost the same content just delivered in an interactive format. It's a little more outcome oriented. But there's a lot of successful authors, at least in the nonfiction world. I mean, right off the top of my head, David Kadavy, or Design for Hackers, created a video course almost as an afterthought, but the video course ended up making about 10 times more money than the book. We helped Ryan Holiday put together Growth Hacker Marketing, which was, you know, from a $2.99 Kindle ebook to a $30 course that's now sold, you know, thousands of units. And in these cases, for them, it was mostly just taking what you already have, making it a little more outcome oriented, like having the messaging be a little tighter that this is the after, you know, almost like those terrible fitness ads, the before and after. You paint the picture of the after a little stronger. It's the same content delivered interactively. You can, like, some elements are pretty easy to add. Like, a lot of people found it valuable to be able to ask the author questions, right? That's something that you can do in a course pretty easily. So you add that kind of stuff. We added a couple of quizzes and interactive exercises. And that was enough, you know, for a $30, $40, $50 course. When you get to the hundreds of dollars, you want to, you know, have it completely professionally produced. But the content is very, very similar for a nonfiction book. Mm-hmm. For a fiction book, it's a little bit different because you need to think about what the outcome is. You need to think about, you know, what is someone getting from my course? I've seen a lot of fiction authors kind of do what, you know, I guess Nick Stephenson has done, what Mark Dawson has done, where they have gotten very good at one very specific part of the fiction writing process, and they sell that knowledge, right? Their outcome is, I'll show you how to market, I'll show you how to write. So for fiction authors, I would try and think about what else are you interested in, almost starting from scratch, but you have a natural advantage because you're a creator. You know how to create, so you still have an advantage. But chances are it's not going to be related to the book unless, you know, you're using yourself as the example and you're selling the art of fiction writing or selling the art of marketing fiction, something along those lines.
Yeah, so it's still a nonfiction spin on a, you know, a fiction topic. So, you know, the biggest question I get is how do I write a novel? So I am going to do a how to write a novel course, but it will be my spin on it. And the same with any books, right? I can do a course on how to write a novel. It'll be completely different to somebody else's course on the same topic. So that's fine as well, isn't it? Doing things that other people have done before.
Yep. And we say this a lot and it comes off as like the soft thing that like you don't really mean, but I do believe we're all qualified to teach in our own unique way because we've all had our unique experiences. Like no two teachers are alike. And for someone in the world, you are a more effective teacher than some other perceived expert, maybe because their life path looks like yours. Maybe they can relate to you better. So just because someone else has, and I keep talking about the example about John and Elliot from Bitfountain, right? They taught people how to build iPhone apps, and they were not traditionally programmers. They had no qualified degree. They were competing against very large companies who taught iPhone programming. But their unique spin of being these two guys that are self-taught, that struggled to learn programming and finally taught themselves, that narrative was so much more compelling that made them better teachers. So it's the same thing that, you know, I see a lot of people worried about, hey, you know, I'm not qualified to teach. Chances are you have something unique in your story that makes you a more effective teacher to certain people. So it doesn't matter if someone else has taught it. You can put your own unique spin on it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like podcasting. I mean, you know, there's lots of podcasts and people listen to the ones that they enjoy and that they resonate with. So it's a similar thing. No, that's cool. So if they... how should they start, I guess? So, you know, we've got people who've written books. Say, you know, I've written loads of books. You know, how do people know which topics are going to actually sell? And is there a way for them to sort of gauge interest in potential topics before they spend a lot of energy creating something?
So two things. One, I would always say focus on the transformation. Like, what do you think is the most valuable transformation you can bring to a student? Like literally that's what it comes down to. So for instance, you have a lot of different topics. Think about for each topic, think about what is the most compelling transformation I can bring to a student, right? Like, so say I'm interested in three topics, how to write a novel. The transformation is you can teach someone how to write a novel. Chances are that might be the most, you know, the strongest transformation you can bring. Then just try pre-selling it. See, are people willing to buy? Is anyone willing to buy this concept? And chances are, even if a few people buy, you can talk to them, find out why they bought, and refine the angle just enough to make more people buy. If no one buys, then, you know, back to the drawing board.
So, well, then I'm interested in your experience of all the courses that you have on your platform. You know, obviously you mentioned the transformation, but what are some good examples of courses that are just selling bucket loads?
That's what's amazing is how, like, specific some of them are and how it's just stuff we don't think about. Like, we have a very expensive course that's doing really well now, teaching actors to give great auditions, right? That's something I don't think about. We have courses that, you know, there's a lot of, like, one of the common myths is all the courses that do well are about selling courses or, you know, like making money online. But we're seeing such an amazing depth of, you know, we have someone recently doing really well selling courses that prepare you for the Florida Board of Cosmetology. So, you know, like some absurdly specific topics. I mean, we have a course doing very well on growing medical marijuana. So
of course, for medical use only.
Yeah, for medical marijuana. So they're legally covered. The diversity of courses is very, very interesting to see. Another story that I'm specifically proud of is we had a watercolor teacher, Angela, who was not, was a little hesitant at first because the only courses she saw succeeding were programming, marketing, design. But now, she's consistently making at least $5,000 a month selling watercolor painting, which is exactly what she's always wanted to do. And personally, we're trying to push more and more of that stuff, just seeing we have guitar classes doing really, really well now. And just seeing that kind of stuff. The biggest difference between people teaching watercolor painting, guitar, and people teaching marketing is people teaching marketing can charge more per unit. People that in some way relate to money can charge more. But a lot of the guitar guys, make it up by selling 10 times more units. Mm. So it doesn't necessarily impact your income. It does impact your economics because you need to sell more copies if you're selling something, random. But back to the specific question about what classes we see doing well, literally changes every single month. There's been the same person, much to Mark Dawson's sadness, has never been our top earner for 2 months in a row, ever. or even for 2 months, period.
Well, I think that's great. And I think as, like you say, the guitar, the tutorial, the watercolor thing, that has to be taught through video. I mean, there's almost no point in buying a book on watercolor, how to do watercolors. You actually need to see it, don't you?
Even something like cooking, right? Cookbooks are such a popular genre of book. It lends itself to video so much better.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. Yeah. And there's no reason, obviously one of the good ways of marketing a course is to have a book with a link to a course.
Yep. It's really interesting, right? There's two things we've seen done. One is obviously using a book to market a course. We're actually talking to Nick Stephenson about that. That's one of his biggest kind of, ways of building traffic, growing leads, distribute a book for free, direct traffic is some kind of lead magnet, and then sell them the course. We've been exploring the other avenue with Ryan Holiday, where his publisher wanted to move books. So we bundled in a book sale with every single course sale. Because, he's working with Random House. They're still, a few years behind evaluating things in order of books. But we helped him sell, another 1,000 units of a paperback book. Mm-hmm. So based on kind of, as an author, if you evaluate what's important to you right now, maybe, you're making a run for the rankings or something, and you really want to push copies of a book, you can use courses for that too. It very seldom makes financial sense unless the goal is, you want to get on a bestseller list or something. But I've seen kind of both strategies work, and they're very complementary.
Yeah, so if people actually want to then build a course, what are the steps that they need to go through in terms of preparing the material before they get onto the technology?
Yep, so it depends if they're going the pre-sale route or not. Let's pretend they're not going the pre-sale route. In that case, the first thing you need is, and anyone writing a book is familiar with this, is an outline. And the way we tell people to do it with courses is think about your transformation. Like, what is the outcome? And your outline is just kind of a path to the transformation, path to the thing. So what I recommend is first coming out with an outline of steps someone needs to take to complete their transformation. Under each step, have shorter lectures that help you accomplish that specific step. And then that's kind of almost your curriculum or whatever you want to call it. And then each smaller section is just a video you record. If it's your first course, I'd recommend keeping it simple. You can even use PowerPoint or Keynote. Basic slides and just talking over slides is good enough for your first course. The most important thing at this stage for someone creating their first course is to not be a perfectionist. Like, just understand the difference between a book and a course. A course is a living product. A book is not, right? Yeah, you can edit your book and so forth, but a book, once it's out there, it's out there. Mm. Courses are iterative. You can, release one module of a course, talk to your students, and then release the second. Mm. And your course, and the biggest mistake I see people make is just, not internalizing that, editing their own videos over and over, being perfectionist about, an or an ah. But what you realize when you ship a course is your course gets better after you talk to people taking it, rather than you editing your videos over and over. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I agree. And the same with podcasting, you know, I try not to edit a lot of this, and I know I say, you know, a lot. Yeah. But human communication, when it's more face to face, which works on video, is people forgive a lot more than they do on a page. And you never get, like, with as authors, we get emails that say, oh, your grammar was wrong, or oh, you know, you made a typo. And you never get that with videos or with audio, do you? It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's more normal, it's more natural. And I'm a huge fan. And I think the other advantage we have with courses is we're best case scenario in year 10, year 15 of courses. In books, we're in year 2000. I don't know how long a book's been around, right? This is an art form that's been perfected and standards are higher. With courses, people are more forgiving. They will, you know, like people are I think 20 years from now, courses look very different. Mm. But right now, people are forgiving. People, you know, and as a teacher, your focus should only be on getting students to the transformation. Again, back to the Bitfountain guys, like they never showed their face on camera until they made $2 million in course sales, right? So like things that we think are important aren't necessarily important for certain topics if we help people reach the results they want. And they did. They had people go from a $30,000 job to a $70,000 job as a starting programmer. When you bring about that kind of transformation, so what if your slides aren't that pretty?
Yeah, exactly. And people are paying for the result. Exactly. So once we've got the outline, and I agree, it is similar to a book, you're kind of structuring things, and then you're breaking that outline down into kind of smaller, even smaller chunks. So how do authors go ahead and actually record that material? What are some of the tools that they're going to need?
Yep. I would recommend starting by keeping it simple. If you're on a Mac, use Keynote. If you're on a Windows computer, use PowerPoint. It'd be nice if you recorded your face in the bottom right corner. You don't have to. I've seen courses succeed without it. Tools we've used on Mac, ScreenFlow is something we use a lot. People on Windows recommend Camtasia. I've not used it personally. Again, as long as you find something that records your screen, almost doesn't matter. If you want to be really quick, you can record video within PowerPoint and Keynote too. The goal here is to just get your stuff done, get your module out there, and start having people go through it. Just start having students buy it, even if you give away a few free copies, like get feedback from real students who want to solve this problem.
Mm. And I use ScreenFlow and Keynote, and I have my little face down in the in the corner. Yeah. And I like that. I think people like to see a face, but hearing a voice is important as well. And I think, so the audio is almost more important, isn't it? I mean, do you see any purely audio with slide downloads? I mean, is it
a lot? I would say a majority of our courses are slides and audio. Okay. I think a lot of, and it's totally fine, but I think a lot of people when they're first starting out are, I don't know if the word is self-conscious, but they don't want to put their face on camera. Mm. Like that happens. And that's, I kind of felt like that initially, like my first course did not, it was all slides. And then I realized if I just put my face on camera, I don't sometimes have to make slides. I save so much time. That's worth it. But then after a while, it's just something that I think it's a process a lot of people go through where they'll be like, hey, I don't want to show my face on camera. Two videos in, they're like, screw it. Like let me just see what, you know, let's just do it. The first course, that question comes up a lot.
Mm. Yeah, it's something you get used to. Same with podcasting. I mean, I don't like my voice, never have, but you get over it. You know, you just, and your voice never sounds the same to other people, right? It's just, you know, but I think the human connection is super important as well. Yep. Okay, so, I mean, obviously we can't go into everything now, and I'll do some links in the show notes so people can see a bit more detail on technology. But after they've made their videos, can you just kind of explain how Teachable works in the sort of setup? Because many people are kind of scared of the technology around kind of course hosting, for example.
Yep. So our goal is to make you not worry about technology. So what that means is we give you everything you need to create, sell, distribute, deliver online courses. So things like, you know, in the past you'd have to use WordPress, like 10 different plugins or something. We give you an easy to use interface where you just upload your content in, set a price, pick some nice images and colors, and you're good to go. If you want to be more advanced, we let you do a lot of things like, you know, do affiliates. You can set up authors in your school for automatic payouts. You can bundle courses together, sell a subscription. There's a lot of, you know, you can completely customize your sales page. There's a lot of advanced features, but at its core, the most simple idea is we don't want you to worry about technology. I think it was actually you that said it. You're like, look, I'm a writer, I'm a creator. I want to create. I want to write. I want to create. I want to teach. I don't want to spend my time dealing with plugins. I value my time too highly to deal with technology.
Yeah, and exactly.
You described exactly what we're trying to be.
Yes. And I should say to everybody, I went through, you know, a process of thinking I would build my own self-hosted thing and just got to the point of bashing my head against the wall, just going, I hate this. I do not want to deal with all these silly plugins, because it's actually, it is easy on Teachable, but it's not easy without a hosted platform. So it's similar to people using WordPress as a website. Yep. It's easy if you use WordPress, but if you're trying to build something from scratch yourself, it's really hard. So that is very cool. And then one of the most difficult things I think for anybody is a sales page, which you do need. I mean, there has to be a way for someone to click a button to buy the course, and you do need some text around that. So what are some of your tips for sales pages?
So the biggest thing is use Teachable. We've tested our sales pages a lot, but honestly, what's important with the sales page is, and you know, there's a lot of great books on writing sales copy and so forth, but the biggest one lesson is, like, no one cares about you. It's what you can do for the student, right? It's not, hey, I've done XYZ. It's like, what are you gonna do for me and why? Social proof is obviously huge. Like, for instance, on our sales page editor, we've made a really easy way to add testimonial blocks. You pick someone's picture, you pick a quote from them, and it just looks like a good testimonial. So on a sales page, that's what's really effective. It's like just keeping the copy focused on what is the outcome for the student, right? Like, what am I getting along with social proof of other people that have gotten it? And, you know, I said it somewhat facetiously that, you know, you should use Teachable, but I do think a couple of things we do are very useful. One is, by uploading a couple of nice images, the page looks good. I think aesthetics are incredibly important when someone's at a purchasing decision. Like, design can be seductive. And if you have a sales page that looks great, that helps a lot. The other thing that's important is having it be your brand. You know, your brand, your domain, for instance, can also sometimes add the professional edge where it concerns. And of course, I mean, this is obvious, people have been selling online products, but clearly stated risk reversal, which means, like, somewhere on the page, you boldly call out the fact that, hey, if you invest in this and this is not for you, you get 100% of your money back, and maybe even you keep something. But those are kind of the critical components of a good sales page.
And what are the differences between Teachable and a site like Udemy? Because a lot of people have heard of Udemy. And so what are the differences?
Yep. So Udemy fundamentally is a marketplace. The positive of a marketplace like Udemy is they do all the marketing for you. The negative of Udemy is, well, there's several, and I still feel like Udemy, for a lot of people, especially when they're starting out, does have its place. So when I say negative, it's not even a hard diss. It's more like the pros and cons. The pros are they do the marketing for you. The cons are you don't get an email address. So you're ultimately you're not really building a business. You're making a little bit of side money. You can't build a business without having someone's email address. It has a reputation for almost being, at least in America, I don't know if this internationalizes as well, but almost being the Kmart of online education. You know, the discount, like, they're going to sell all their courses for $10. Well, we talk a lot about how you should charge more, be the premium product in your space. Udemy also has the risk of, if you do your marketing for your Udemy course, people will get cross-sold competitive courses, which is, you know, you can, if you bring someone to how to write a novel on Udemy, they'll get 10 other how to write a novel courses from other people.
Which might be cheaper.
and Udemy courses are commoditized, and you don't want your education to be a commodity. So I think Udemy can be an okay place to start. But once you kind of find your feet, you want to move to your own platform. And even then, you don't want to put your best material on Udemy. You want to put, like, quick commoditized courses that you're okay being a commodity, with the goal of eventually, like you cannot have your premium course on Udemy. There's just no way. Like, that's, you know, it's just not worth it.
Yeah, I agree. And the discounting is a problem there, where people have put it up for, say, $250, and then suddenly they see it for sale at $10, and they're like, what just happened? Yeah. So I think if people do use Udemy, I read all their terms and conditions, and it was getting crazy. So I agree that Teachable is definitely better. If you have some way of selling, and I think that's the big point, isn't it? So if somebody builds a course on Teachable, nobody is going to stumble upon it.
We get the odd person getting lucky on Google,
So it is for authors who do have a platform or who are building a platform and can send traffic to it.
The alternative, which some people have done without a platform, without a traffic, is affiliates. If you have someone with an audience who likes your content and is willing to sell it for you, you know, we have an inbuilt affiliate program, and you can use that as a way of selling it. We have some people where the entire sales strategy is affiliates. But yes, in general, that's still something you need to think about, is how am I going to sell this? How am I going to distribute this? And then, you know, and we help people learn marketing funnels, so forth. But I mean, that's, you need to, you know, internalize that and learn that.
Yeah, but as we said at the beginning, a really good way is to have a book that has a link to a course. So if people have paid, say, $5.99 for an ebook, they may well be interested in a video course on the same material. Yep. So yep. Taking it further, I think that's something that's accessible to all authors who sometimes turn away in horror from other marketing.
Yep.
So that's really good. And then I guess the other, we've talked a bit about the benefit of the hosted service. So, you know, I pay Teachable a monthly amount, and then instead of having to maintain all the technology, you guys do all that. And just mention some of the other things you have that sort of make the platform stand out, like the video stuff.
For example. Absolutely. We don't charge for a lot of stuff people charge for. So we have unlimited hosting, unlimited video bandwidth. So for a lot of people, you just save more money on video when you join. Unlimited courses, students, and so forth. Like, we have some people running schools with, you know, 100,000 plus students, and that's all included. But we've focused a lot, not just on, traditionally there've been kind of two kinds of software. There's been the internet marketers building stuff that's very, very good at marketing, but a really bad student experience. Mm-hmm. Then you have the traditional learning management systems that have a lot of like education features, but are not built to sell. We try to marry those two together and give teachers a powerful tool that helps them on the e-commerce side. So you can, you know, have multiple pricing plans per course, charge monthly, charge annually, do affiliates, do authors, have 100 different currencies, bundle your courses, you know, like do all these really cool commerce things. But on the other hand, we've tried to focus on the student experience too. So students have a nice lecture player. Students can make their video go faster or slower. Students can track their progress in courses. I'm trying to like kind of merge those two ideas together and build Teachable. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, and you're adding things all the time, aren't you?
Yep. We're now 16 people in New York City. And culture-wise, that's also the difference. We're not built by internet marketers. Like, I love a lot of internet marketers. They're my friends. But we have different priorities, right? Mm. If an internet marketer releases a course hosting tool, their goal is either to have $1 million launch for their course hosting tool so that they can build a new version a year from now, 2 years from now. For us, like, this is our software. We're going to do this forever. We're purely a software company. We've raised venture capital to be a software company. Every single person on the team works every day to make the software better. Mm. And that's what I think in time is also going to kind of make a big difference, is this is the one thing we do, right? Like, this is 100% what we do. And every day there's 16 people that come into work every day trying to make this better. So I think that's culturally a difference between us and a lot of other, you know, I guess, marketing tools.
Yeah, and I've been very impressed by your enthusiasm and your passion for this and the platform, which is excellent. So people on the show will know that I'm really hot for virtual reality and I'm a bit of a futurist. What do you see the next kind of 5 to 10 years? Do you see online education moving into VR kind of space? You know, what do you see coming in the next 5 to 10 years?
So I will caveat this with the fact that I'm not specifically a VR enthusiast, but it's common sense. It has to, right? Like, I don't know much about VR, but it has to. It'd be naive to think it wouldn't. Again, what I would be a little concerned about, is time frames are always very hard to predict because for a long time, this is something that only a few enthusiasts do. Then it gets mainstream, and then again, it hits a critical mass where it goes like crazy. But I was actually watching a talk by Peter Gruber, the owner of the Warriors and a bunch of other owner of Man. He's very, very heavily invested in VR, and he's thinking a lot about bringing the stadium experience to your home. And I think the same thing has to happen with education, where whatever the perceived values of being in, you know, an actual classroom environment, all of that stuff. I mean, yeah, you can bring that. I think there'll be two stages. The first stage is you bring those experiences to the home, like you bring the experience of being in a classroom, and then there'll be a bit of soul searching. Be like, is the classroom experience the best? Like, can we build immersive experiences that teach by doing? And I think that would be kind of the next wave that's more exciting.
But as you say, it will be a while off.
Yeah, it's hard to predict. I don't know necessarily will be a while off. It's just, I don't want to try and predict these things because it's just very hard to. And personally, I believe as an educator or as a company in the space, I personally believe in letting the space, letting it happen and then reacting really fast than trying to be at the forefront of it, unless you're doing it for passion. If you're passionate about it, then yeah, it totally makes sense. But if you're thinking strategically, I would wait until it's happening and then react really fast rather than try and be the first person in the space.
Yes. Yeah, so it's funny in that way that, you know, podcasting really only, I guess, 2014, it really took off, didn't it? And video courses were at the end of 2015 as we record this. Yeah. So getting into video courses now is a good idea, right? It's not too late to get into this. It's actually just the start of a boom.
Yep. Yep. If not, we're gonna be out of business. No, it is. And I mean, I also say that facetiously because the mission behind the company is not to be a video course hosting platform. The mission behind our company is to empower. We think the best teachers of the future will be entrepreneurs, and we want to empower them. And right now, video course is the best tool of doing that. But yeah, as in, if you know, VR becomes a thing, you know, that's what we'll do. Our goal and what we like ultimately think about all the time is how can we empower more teacher entrepreneurs, more people that are not just teachers, but running their entire business themselves, making a financial gain from their teaching. Because for too long, I feel like those two things have been divorced. Like the idea of being a teacher and almost being a capitalist, making more money when you teach better or whatever, those two concepts have been divorced. And we believe you're going to have better, more motivated teachers with that financial outcome. And, you know, there can be full-time teachers, self-employed teachers, and that's what, you know, we're excited about.
Fantastic. So where can people find you and Teachable online?
Awesome. So Teachable is at teachable.com. We're no longer, for people watching this that have heard of Fedora, we used to be called usefedora.com. We're now teachable.com. Personally, I think the best way of getting in touch with me is on Twitter. I try and maintain an active Twitter and mostly fail, but it's still probably the best way of getting in touch. It's my full name, Ankur Nagpal, on Twitter.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Ankur. That was great.
Thanks, Joanna. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.